Hey, everybody, welcome to a coffee table version of the OIG Roundtable. I am Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, Abuse Support. Wade McFall is on a kickoff meeting with a client on a new team, so he is unable to make today. So
he's in a hoodie.
He is not in a hoodie. He is in a suit, a virtual suit, but he's in a suit. But I've got my other partner in crime, Mike Kachansky, who is also wearing a hoodie, so it's good to know that we at least got together. Mike Kachansky, retired SAC, special agent in charge from the OIG, retired Northeast UPIC director, and senior director of payment integrity here at Advise Health. So we want to talk today. There was a press release that came out the other day, and I loved it because I was just talking to some people not a week ago about it. It was a press release that came out. It was a case out of the Eastern District of New York. It was an OIG case, worked with four other agencies. So it came out of my old office, out of Region 2 Office of Investigations. And it was a Medicaid case, $120 million, Medicaid and Medicare. And it was a couple of adult social daycares from a 10-year period. If anybody saw the press release, it was a 10-year period, 2016 to 2026, $120 million in fraudulent prescriptions that were going to the same pharmacy. And the patients were part of the adult social daycare, and they were getting kickbacks to the tune of gift cards and cash and things of that sort. And the patients were all going with their same prescription to the same pharmacy to get those filled. And so there was kickback arrangement between all of them. And it certainly appears from the press release that there was a cooperator or multiple cooperators, because in the press release, they actually quoted text messages that were going on between two of the nefarious parties. And so there was probably a cooperator in there. But you know, the interesting thing, I was actually just talking about these kinds of cases a couple of weeks ago with some people, because there was a whole discussion about kickbacks in the healthcare space and the adult social daycare space, and more importantly about the culturalness of those, and that a lot of these adult social daycares in New York are culturally based. They're owned and operated by people of a particular culture, whatever it may be, and the people that go to them, the members that go to them, or the residents, or whatever the clients, whatever they call them, are all typically of the same cultural background. And that's not uncommon. You see that quite often. People are comfortable going to organizations, you know, doctors that are of similar cultural backgrounds, because people tend to understand each other a little bit better. And, you know, these kinds of cases have been going on forever. In the mid-90s, when I first got hired at OIG, we were working a lot of those in Brighton Beach, where people were getting, for whatever reason, the old Russians love Angora. So we would go to houses and we would find that people had Angora sweaters and whatever else. And so it doesn't really change. But, you know, obviously in this case, what stands out, and from the SIU perspective, the challenge is that we know that in kickback cases, someone has to tell on themselves. And in the SIU space, you very frequently will not be able to find someone who's willing to cooperate to that extent. Once in a while, you'll get a nugget and you'll have that. But, you know, generally speaking, in the SIU space, you have a little bit of a challenge doing that. But where you can make some inroads is through the data. And, you know, in this case, Matt, there's a couple of things, right? We know that in these instances, the members jump from facility, adult social daycare facility, to adult social daycare facility, because they're all getting these kickbacks paid. All, I'm being exaggerative with that, but kickbacks are paid out, gift cards, and so cash, whatever it may be. People will go wherever they're going to be able to get some more money or get stuff. So you see that there's this ping-ponging effect of the members. They go from place to place to place. But the other piece of it is, if you have all these people getting prescriptions for whatever, whether it be pharmacy, DME, whatever it may be, same doctor, same pharmacy, and more importantly, the same medication, like, these are red flags that data should show. And I know, you know, our New York teams are working on a lot of these cases, and these patterns are all the same.
Yeah, and more so, because you throw in transportation. They all have to get to these SADCs somehow. They're all taking the Medicaid buses, and they're all getting charged for the same mileage somehow. With the ordering physician for the medication, there's no prior history with the patients. So how are they prescribing this medication, or this whatever it is they're prescribing, equipment, and having never seen the patient before? You'll see from the billing from the SADCs, the numbers of people that they're supposedly housing per day is astronomical. And then you can do some, you know, some simple social media lookups to see, you know, what's the square footage of this place? And it's a 400 foot apartment, you know, square foot apartment. You know, how are you getting 200 people in there? You know, where's the kitchen that you're supposed to be providing the food? All of those things can be done really, really quickly based on the data, the trends that you're seeing there, and simple public information database searches. It's, and we've opened up dozens of cases in New York with our clients, and we're seeing the same patterns, the same ownership, the same members going from one to the other, the right. same ordering physicians following them, or they're following the ordering physicians, however it may be. And then we go in and we get the sign up sheets and things like that. And it's, you know, a fraction of the people that are actually there that were, they were billing for every day. It's right. phenomenal what you see.
And so to some extent, I mean, so you brought up a great one, which is the addition, which is transportation, right? So in some cases, maybe everybody's getting a little bit of a kickback, right? Because the adult social daycares are paid for half days or full days, and it's like a per diem amount and all of that. And so there are a ton of potential ancillary services that are out there that you could see, and transportation becomes one important piece of it, because you're right, people have to get there. And then the frequency of prescriptions, like, is everybody getting the same prescription, whatever that may be? Are they all going to the exact same pharmacy?
Same PT, the same podiatry services, you know, when they right. bring those specialists in.
Right. And the thing, which leads me to my point, which is that there's social daycare and there's medical daycare, and they're a little bit different. They have some of the same things, but, you know, in the social adult social daycare setting, you don't typically see, you know, instances where all of these people are getting the same prescriptions, the same, like the PT, OT, all of that may be a separate thing. You don't typically see that. And that's why it is important. And let's get back to this public records piece. It's important that when you're working on one of these cases, what is the place designated as? Is it designated as a medical daycare? Is it designated as a social daycare? And I will say collaterally, it's similar where if you're conducting an investigation involving home health or hospice, what are these organizations designated as? Are they designated as home health? Are they designated as hospice? Are they designated as both? Because you're going to see that sometimes the payment policies may not be the same. And right. so you could be working in a home health environment and a hospice environment. You get a provider of both. And is the provider following the rules for home health? Are they following the rules for hospice? We've seen that on a couple cases that we've worked on here. Some projects I've worked on where we've seen that as a difference, where the place is listed as both home health and hospice, and they're applying the wrong policy to when they bill. And so you have to be cognizant of that. But in that same vein, in these public record searches, it's one of those exact instances where are you seeing all of these people going to the same place? What is that place? And does that place have the ability to support the census that the billings are reflecting? I know one of the last cases I worked at OIG involved a provider who got excluded from a kickback arrangement for MRIs, and he was a part owner of an adult social daycare. He was excluded, what have you. And they were running the adult social daycare out of a catering hall during the week. And one of the things that I discovered was that there were instances where the catering hall had an event the same day that the social daycare. And so they literally put up, like, you know, the old school doctor foldable curtain. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Like a fake divider. They literally put that.
Yeah, the accordion divider. Yeah.
Yeah. They literally put that up and said, okay, this side is the daycare today. This side is for Joey's bar mitzvah.
It's the bar mitzvah. Yeah. And one of the daycares we saw was running a nightclub at night, charging people entry fees to come into the place for a rave, you know. And
yeah,
another one is a gym. It's right. Legitimately a gym, and they're selling memberships to the members. Well, and the kickback is they get the they get it for a reduced price.
And so the question then ultimately is, like, was what they were doing by having that divider, was it creating an environment where the social daycare services weren't able to be met? Like, there's a whole other set of questions that come up. But when you're talking about something like the gym, and ultimately the kickback is like a free membership to the gym or whatever it may be, right? There's a whole bunch of these collateral consequences. I mean, there's nothing better than seeing your 90-year-old great-grandfather huffing it out on the treadmill, right?
It's nice.
Let's talk for a little bit as we wrap up a little bit, but what are some of the, from a data perspective, because these cases, so you typically find these more in the Medicaid space than you do in the commercial space. Correct. There may be a commercial carve out for them, but these are typically Medicaid cases. What are some of the areas, and we have our fortune is that we have a large number of SIU clients that are all in the same geographic area. So you have this ability to kind of amalgamate data and look at data from, if we open up a case on one provider, chances are we can open up that case across that provider case on other plans. But what are some of the things that we should be looking at from a data perspective on these adult social daycares? There are some telltale signs, right? Because $120 million is $120 million, but there's a bunch of collateral things that can help.
Yeah, look for where the daily enrollment, the daily numbers of patients seems larger than normal. Then you look at some, it's 100 people or 50 people a day. If you see them, those numbers being in the hundreds of people a day, and it never really varies, even on holidays and things like that, that's a telltale sign. If you see the same patients in multiple ones, 4 hours at this one, 4 hours in another one, that's a telltale sign that they might not be going to either or just one. Look for if the ambulance or not ambulance, but the van service or whatever, if it's a large number of patients per day or a large percentage of the patients that are going there, that's probably not happening because there's a lot of, and you got to see where these people live versus where the van is charging for the mileage and all that stuff to see if it makes sense. If the van is charging for the same miles for every person, that's probably all made up. And it's look for it and go back to the data, but go to the public databases. Are a lot of these places owned by the same people? And are the same patients going to multiple ones, either on the same day or in consecutive days or just for this period of time, then this period of time, you can see that they're just using the patient's information to bill when they're probably not going to these places.
So not to interrupt you, but I'm going to interrupt you. But so when you're looking at these adult social daycares, where are some of those public, what are some of those publicly available sources where you can go and find out that information?
Well, to look up like where the, how the building is, coded or zoned, you can go to like the city, go into the city's general public database and type in the address and see what it's zoned as. The one I talked about earlier where they were getting 200 or 300 people a day, it was a private residence. It was zoned as a private residence. And then we looked it up on Google Earth, it was a condemned building.
Right.
Yeah.
So you got
searches.
You have Google, you have city tax rolls, which are public, right? Block and lot number, which you can find by doing some searching.
Real estate sites.
Right. And then I'm also thinking that we're starting with the provider contract, who's listed as the owner. And then let's go and look and see if this is an LLC. Are they registered in the state in which they're doing business? What's their LLC? Who are other people that might be listed? Do those people appear in other documents or things of that sort? I know that for a lot of states, you can go in and do LLC searches by name. So therefore, you can find potentially multiple companies that people own to get to that. But that becomes an important piece. So let's just talk. So you got databases for the public information, and then you've got all your billing data, which helps to bring home some of this ping-ponging and some of the things involving like everybody going to the same pharmacy, everybody getting the same prescription,
Yeah, run beneficiary histories and see, you know, on some of the members and see if there's commonalities throughout in terms of other specialty billings, the DME billings, pharmacy billings, all of that.
Right. And in this one, the thing that's interesting to me is that in this case, it's a 10-year period. It was $120 million. It's $12 million a year to a particular pharmacy. I don't know what the average mom and pop pharmacy does in gross billings, but I would tend to think that $12 million in billings to Medicare is probably, or Medicaid is probably a number that's off, that's askew, particularly if it's a local mom and pop pharmacy versus a chain pharmacy where there's going to be the potential that there's going to be a larger influx of patients coming in. But as a mom and pop pharmacy, you're dealing with probably a more segmented, and particularly if you're dealing with culturally segmented groups of people, you're probably going to be seeing that those numbers don't comport. And that's where in your SIU, it's important to have those conversations with the PBM, right? Get that data and have those conversations to see like what's going on. Like, you know, who's my top billing provider? Who's my top billing pharmacy, or who are my top five pharmacies in this zip code?
Yeah. Yep.
Right. And then who's the prescriber, right? Because is the prescriber there? And why are all these people who are all at the same adult social daycare getting the same prescriptions from the same pharmacy with the same providers? It just doesn't pass this thing
before. Yeah.
Right. Now the collateral thing to close with is, number one, you may want to get physical surveillance on some of this to see what happens. And that's where we've been helping a lot of our clients in that. And we recommend very, very strongly that SIU investigators do not go out in the field and do not do things like drive-bys and what have you. On-sites are a little different, another topic for another day. But our general feeling is that investigators going out in their personal car and taking pictures with their cell phones and all of that is a no-no. Our team of investigative surveillance investigators has been doing this for quite a while for a lot of our clients at a cost savings to them, because we're finding that ROI is very high. The other piece of this is that investigators should just be conversant in the multitude of different data sets that are out there. And that's going to be where that prescription drug event data, or PDE data, comes into play with the adult social daycare. And then the last piece is, if you are working on a case in which there is a clear cultural difference, you have to also be cognizant of the fact that if you're going to try to speak to members, you might be spinning your wheels if you don't speak that language. And so if you know that you've got an adult social daycare, particularly with an older Medicare, Medicaid population, there's a very strong likelihood that people may not speak English as well as you, or be able to have a good conversation in English. So you may want to think about having a translator ready to go beforehand, so that if the person is having a difficult time conversing with you in their native, in English, that you can revert back to their native language. And the only caveat I will give you is that if you are not used to interacting with translators, reach out to us, and we're happy to help with understanding that, because there are some nuances to conducting an interview with a translator. There are some nuances, and people should be aware of those nuances of how to talk to the translator, how to talk to the person you're talking to, and how you get that feedback. So there are some nuances to that, but there are lots of translation services that are on demand, and you should be ready to have those for instances where you're talking to members who may not be able to converse. They may have information to share with you, they just may not be able to share it with you because they can't convey it in a manner.
The thing to keep in mind is they may be complicit because they are getting kickbacks, so they might not be too willing to talk to begin with.
Right, and that's another piece. That's another piece of the puzzle. So these are great cases, because they really do tend to have a lot of tentacles to them, and a lot of different pieces to the puzzle. So we obviously encourage people to work on these cases. We encourage you to data mine for these cases, particularly for people in the SIU space that are working on adult social daycares. You have a captive audience. This is, to an extent, not any different than the cases involving people that live in low income or senior buildings, and which you've got ancillary services, podiatry and things of that sort, where they come into the community room and you've got a captive audience of people where there's waivers copays, there's kickbacks, all of that. They're very similar, and it's just a matter of doing some of that public record searching, some of that due diligence, and putting some of those smaller pieces of the puzzle together. So interesting topic. That press release was an interesting one, not just because it was from my old region, but it was an interesting case because it really did touch upon the main issue, which is the kickbacks and then all of the tentacles that come out of that. So good talk, Matt. Glad you and I had our sweatshirts on. Hopefully next week, Wade will have a sweatshirt on as well. And Wade should be back next week. So for those, again, that tune in, we appreciate it. Again, Spotify, YouTube, you can get all of our prior OIG roundtables. We appreciate everybody signing on for this week's abridged version of the OIG coffee table. And we'll see you all on the next OIG roundtable. Have a good one, everyone.
Thanks, all.